You're listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. Slavery plays such an integral role in the American story. And while, of course, it does not exist today in this country, its history has shaped all of our institutions, our government structures, and our culture, our religion, our music, just about everything that we know about being American. This point has been made before, but it was recently demonstrated more publicly and thoroughly with the New York Times 1619 Project, which has sometimes been declared controversial, not for misinterpreting facts, but for the very notion that slavery played a critical role in crafting American stories and traditions. On Monday, a new article by the Washington Post uncovered a new disturbing fact that further elucidates this idea. The idea that more than 1,700 congressmen in American history once enslaved black people. Now, it's not news that there were members of Congress who owned slaves, who owned human beings. We've known about that forever, really. And if you think about the history of Southeast Michigan, we can think of some very prominent names who fall into that category. But the number here, 1,700 Congress people, is significant. And it means something. It means a lot of things as we try to sort of sort through what the history of this country means to us today. Joining us now to talk more about this reporting is Julie Z. Wild. She's a reporter with the Washington Post and one of the people who contributed to this new investigation titled More Than 1,700 Congressmen Once Enslaved Black People. This is who they were and how they shaped the nation. Julie Wild, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So you start the article by writing, from the founding of the United States until long after the Civil War, hundreds of elected leaders writing the nation's laws were current or former slave owners. How did you guys find this out? How did you come to this this conclusion?
Well, I started with a list of every member of Congress who was born before 1840, meaning they were adults before the Civil War.
Uh-huh.
And basically went through the list one at a time, looking to see, was this man a slave owner or not? And eventually, after months of research, came to a list of more than 1,700 who were. And the research is still ongoing. I'm getting emails every few minutes from readers who are sending me more documents about more congressmen.
Hmm. And talk about just the process of trying to confirm this kind of thing. It's very popular right now for people to look back into their own histories and discover things about their families. How difficult is it to decide whether someone in history was a slaveholder?
Some of those judgment calls are harder than others. And I think if you look at some of the really prominent examples recently, like Alexander Hamilton or mm-hmm. Johns Hopkins, there have been some intense debates about what the handwritten records of the 18th or 19th century should mean to us now when we read them. So some are hard and some are easy. Most of my research was in the census, looking at the 1790 through 1860 censuses. But there are all sorts of documents.
And many people, of course, know that many of the founders were slaveholders, but not everyone knows that members of Congress, I guess, were slaveholders or former slaveholders, and that they weren't just from the American South. Now, here in Southeast Michigan, we have been having a conversation for a long time about a slaveholding here in Detroit and some very prominent members of Detroit history who were slaveholders. One, I think, that immediately comes to mind for everybody here is Lewis Cass, who was a member of the U.S. Senate, but was a slaveholder here in Detroit. The most prominent public high school in Detroit is named for him still, as is one of our major streets. But talk about the extent of this. I mean, I think that's one of the things that really jumps out, is that for so many people, when you say the words American slavery, they think of the South, and they should, because that's where it was concentrated. But this was not exclusive to the South, and in terms of people who went off to Washington to represent Americans, it definitely was not. It was definitely not exclusive to the South.
It really wasn't. Somebody I was reading about this morning was George Wallace Jones, who represented Michigan. He actually represented three different states, because he was a territorial delegate from Michigan. When his part of Michigan got turned into Wisconsin, he represented Wisconsin. Then he moved to Iowa and became a senator from Iowa. But these are all northern states. He was a slaveholder. He was actually a college friend of Jefferson Davis, and continued to support his old buddy Jefferson Davis during the Civil War. He was arrested. He represented Michigan. Somebody I'm still looking for information about, if any of your listeners know any more about him, is Gabriel Richard from Michigan, another one of those early territorial delegates. Who I don't have much information about, because it was early. If anybody does, please get in touch.
There are lots of folks here who know about Gabriel Richard, who is another really prominent name in our history, is the person who is credited with coming up with the slogan for the city of Detroit after a fire leveled the city. He came up with this idea of resurgence and rebuilding. He's a very prominent name, and I think a lot of people know about his involvement with slavery, for instance.
Well, you clearly know much more than I do, so please get in touch about that one. I'd like to.
We actually have a city historian now here in Detroit. His name is Jamon Jordan, and he is an absolutely wonderful resource for this subject specifically, the history of slavery here in Detroit. And he's also a listener, so if he is listening, I would tell him to reach out to you. But we can connect you with him. Yeah,
great. I think that one of my hopes for the database is that it will be useful to people who are doing what Detroit and a lot of cities are doing, which is reexamining that history and looking at maybe our public monuments, our public schools, who are they named after? If you want to look up, hey, my elementary school is named for this congressman I don't know much about, you can type him into the database now, and I hope that'll be helpful.
Yeah. So I want to go back to something you said at the beginning of our conversation about this being true after 1865, which is the end of the Civil War. I think some people might look at this and say, wait a minute, slavery was abolished after the Civil War. How is it that there were former slaveholders that held office even into the 20th century? I want to put that question to you.
Right. So what's key is what you said, they're former slaveholders. Mm-hmm. These are people who were slaveholders, Civil War ended, and then they were elected to Congress.
Yeah.
If you look at Georgia, for example, there was a period of time after Georgia seceded and then became part of the United States again, and they then sent a congressional delegation entirely made up of former slaveholders,
wow,
every single one of them.
Wow.
And that was true of a lot of states, though I think Georgia's the only one sending only slaveholders. But it continues all the way into the 20th century. There's a Confederate soldier representing Alabama from 1900 to 1914.
I also want to talk just a little about what you think people should draw from this. These are kind of messy conversations, and they tend to be presented in very stark terms, I think, when we talk about them. But for instance, in the reporting, you guys point out that there were people who were anti-slavery who also once held slaves. I mean, there's this continuum, I think, of involvement with American slavery that that ensnares a lot of different kinds of people, and people who you might not necessarily just say, well, of course that person was a slaveholder because they lived in the South and they owned a plantation and they did this and they did that. Talk just a little about the difficulty of sorting through who these people are and what they mean, I guess, that what they mean now.
I mean, in no way is this a yes or no question where you can just say, okay, this person's a slaveholder, this person's not, I know everything I need to know. That's not how this works. These people have very complicated stories, like some of the people you were alluding to, people who had a lot of anti-slavery activities in their political careers, even as they were keeping people in slavery at their own homes. That sort of story, I think that just knowing, hey, we have a list of who's a slaveholder and who's not, is helpful to telling those stories when you want to talk about somebody like John Floyd, for example, who floated the idea of getting rid of slavery in Virginia when mm-hmm. he was the governor of Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
That story gets told a lot more often than the fact that Floyd was a slave owner.
Yeah.
I'm trying to add some context to those stories, but it's not the whole story.
Yeah, and as you point out, this is not just a story. This is a database that readers of the Post can interact with and find information. I imagine that database will grow and change quite a bit over time.
It will. It's really already, just in the past couple of days, people have sent me so much valuable information to help grow the database. And we've made the actual data itself public and downloadable so that historians, maybe somebody's doing an analysis of a bill or a vote in Congress, they can use this as a layer of their analysis if they want.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to take a quick phone call here from Rich in Huntington Woods. Rich, welcome to the show.
Hi. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Rich.
Thank you so much. This is such an important conversation as everybody who cares has begun to understand.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to introduce the conversation to a little history of Royal Oak Charter Township.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the 100th anniversary of the Grant School. And South Oakland County had its own history, not the slavery that you're discussing, but the 20th century Jim Crow
yes.
activities
yes.
that destroyed the black community here, marginalized it, yet kept the people in the community, kept the spirit alive to create 9 white suburbs,
yep.
of which I live in one of them. we're now engaged in fact, Saturday, we're having a photo op at the Grant School to publicly begin the conversation. We've been doing research on creating a documentary. So I hope at some point you invite folks from Friends of Royal Oak Charter Township
Absolutely.
To explore the conversation.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you called and raised that issue, Rich. I mean, it's another of the, you know, really important tentacles of this history that of course slavery ends in 1865. But so many other institutions grow up around the idea of inequality, and they grow up not just in the former slaveholding states, but all over the nation. And we have lots of complicated history here in Michigan that we still, as you point out, need to spend some time, I think, unpacking and thinking about. We've only got about a minute and a half left, Julie, but I want to ask you about your interview with Senator Cory Booker for this piece. Can you tell us just a little about what he said, how his everyday realities as a senator are still affected by slavery's legacy?
Yes, he talked about walking through the halls of Congress and noticing that these slaveholders' statues are standing around him. I think
They're
he pointed
there.
Some of them out to a Post photographer recently, actually. And he also connected this topic with a bill that he's been promoting. He's trying to pass a bill to create a study of the feasibility of and practicality and worked on this of reparations as an idea. That's an idea that he has been promoting. And he said that, look, this shows how much of our history we really haven't grappled with yet. And we need to really do some serious inquiry.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Julie Weil, reporter with The Washington Post. Really great to have you here to talk about this really great work. And if you're interested in checking out the story or this database that they've put together, you'll find that at WashingtonPost.com. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. Okay, that's going to do it for us today. Come back tomorrow when Senator Debbie Stabenow is going to join the program to talk about the push to pass federal voting rights protections. And we'll hear the odd, hilarious, and illuminating story about a plan to create a libertarian utopia that was foiled by bears. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll talk again tomorrow.